This week's topic is collaboration or collaboration, depending on your point of view. The perspective that most people have of collaboration is a beneficial one. We instantly think collaboration is a good thing. So I just would like to frame it in a slightly different text. So I have some notes here I'll read. Collaboration is a necessity in life for all of us. No one is an island. The idea that we all collaborate in our work and life is an obvious one, but the actual analysis of how we collaborate seems to be taken for granted. Just like driving, we all make assumptions and take the outcomes for granted with little awareness or analysis of the means and processes involved. The idea that collaboration is good seems to have become a reflex position. We rarely question if collaboration is the best option or what type of collaborative endeavor is productive. The saying, designed by committee, is not one that exudes a positive perspective. The idea that more points of view and options can only be beneficial is naive and can be a source of conflict, dissent, and dissatisfaction. So my intention is to table some ideas and perspectives about how, when, and why collaboration should be managed. The hope is that after some discussion, we will end up with a broader perspective of which types of collaboration and what size groups and dynamics are most beneficial.
So while you were reading that, I was having a bit of a think. And one of the assumptions that we make about collaboration is that we need a diversity of people in the group. And I'd agree. A lot of the time, it's great to have a wide range of diverse views, thoughts, backgrounds, etc. I think there's also times when we're collaborating that we could form common cohorts. So I think just defaulting to let's make sure we've got as much diversity as we possibly can could be a little bit tricky because we're leaving out those times when the comfort of being with a common background cohort, those sorts of things, could actually be beneficial as well. So that was my first thought from that. Toby, what was your first thought from that?
So what I thought hearing that is I just reflected on the many groups that I've been part of and managed and helped and sort of observed over the years where we've sort of adopted the mantra, the sort of the idea of collaboration good, because we can see all of the benefits that diverse perspectives can give. We can see all the growth that is usually associated with it, and especially in the context that I mostly live of software development and new product development, collaboration is how we discover new things usually, and that's taken for granted as a good thing. But I've seen these groups struggle, and they often struggle because they have the idea that collaboration is good, but they fail to ask themselves, what's our process for collaborating? And what is the thing we're collaborating around? And what's the real problem to be solved? And what is it that, what's the needs to be met for the group? What's the needs of the work? What's the need of the situation? And sort of, we don't question that. And once you start questioning it, you end up in a conversation that ends up being not about the form of the collaboration or if it's situational, the best way to do things. You end up sort of discussing if collaboration is good or not, which tends to derail it very, very quickly. So I've seen both peers and mobs and teams generally becoming increasingly frustrated over this tension that they uphold collaboration as a good, but they forget to talk about why are we collaborating and or sort of what's currently the reason and the way we should do this. What's the requisite diversity and sort of what's also the limits of how many different perspectives we can gainfully integrate at this particular time due to issues of momentum and social capital and trust. So I have all of these ideas sort of swimming around in my head going, yes, we need a frame that is more nuanced around this.
So I think the first thing is, what is collaboration? You know, for example, let's take it to a really silly extreme. If it's kind of co-laboring, people working together, it's very obvious that an entire office building full of thousands of people are working together in the same physical space. But we instantly don't recognize that as collaboration because it isn't. So it isn't just people working together. What is the thing that is collaboration?
I think that's tricky. And that's what sort of delights me about it, but it's also what makes it slightly iffy. The sort of, because I like the if we don't start anywhere else, starting with the co-laboring frame, as you put out, is actually, I think, a good starting point. So what does it mean to co-labor, if that's sort of, and how's that different from cooperating? But, and I think that's sort of, if you start over there, then you get this, well, are we working on the same thing? Okay, so we have a proximity effect. We need to be adjacent in the domain and in the thing. That seems to be a thing that most people agree on. What they don't agree on is things like, if we're collaborating, how sort of divorced in time and space can we be? Where some current trends are sort of all about, it's not a collaboration unless you're sitting in my lap, which has become increasingly hard during a pandemic. So we need to sort of back off a bit about that we're sitting in the same spot. Then is it we're working on the same artifact? And is it sort of how bound to the same time point perspective is that? And I've seen great collaborations spring out from various modes of working on the same thing. And I would sort of group them all together as, well, these are all collaborations. They just have slightly different governing constraints. And that's due to sort of either physically, obviously, I would say that these conversations are a collaboration, but it spans sort of, we're halfway around the planet and we're still working on the same thing. So obviously the sitting close together is more about sharing a mental space than a physical space. But we can also collaborate across time. A lot of gainful sort of co-creation happens when I do my little bit and you do your little bit, and then we come together to integrate. So where exactly do these boundaries actually go, and how often do we have that conversation?
When you guys were asking what's the definition of collaboration or what does it mean, instantly I thought, yes, I know I'm a fly in the ointment type of person, but I thought the best way to define collaboration is not to define collaboration, but to define everything that it's not. It's not dictatorship. It's not tyrannical command and control. It's rather than look at what it is, look at what all the subsets that it's not part of, and then you have a better idea the sort of cloud that is collaboration, because it's very amorphous. It can be many shapes and sizes. And then the other thing I realized when I was thinking about that was collaboration has a certain responsibility with it, because just because you work on something with someone else doesn't mean you're like in the same office building. Doesn't mean that you're collaborating unless you buy in. You actually are responsible for the outcome, good or bad. That's the collaborative part, that you're sharing responsibility. So I think a lot of people forget the responsibility side of collaboration rather than, you know, and they just focus on the mechanism.
I think that that's beautiful, in that if we say that in order for it to be a collaborative effort, there's a few things we need to take into account. We need to have some shared sense of responsibility. Okay. There seems to be a spectrum where sort of, well, we need to be roughly similarly responsible for it in order for us to jointly be able to collaborate. And we also need to have fairly equal, not totally democratic, but we need to have some sense of we're peers in this. It's not a directing, dictating part of kind of deal, because when it becomes that, it becomes something else distinctly non-collaborative. So we need to be, for some sense of equal, we need to be equals in this effort, both in terms of responsibility for how we do the work and for the outcomes.
Two very simple pictures in my head, and I wanted to test these as examples of collaboration as well. You know when you see in the movies and they're driving the big spikes into the ground, so there's two people and they've got the big hammers, or what are they called? Mallet things?
Sledgehammers.
Big sledgehammers, and they're standing either side and they're taking turns to hit it in. I mean, that's taking that responsibility into account, because if you get your rhythm wrong, you're going to end up smashing together somewhere badly. And then the other picture in my head are those really long manual saws with the two-handled ones. So one person on one end and one person on the other, sawing backwards and forwards. So my question is, with the driving in the spike, that one person could do by themselves. But we've often seen in the pictures that it's two people doing it. I'm imagining that gets it done more quickly. And then with the saw, I think it would be really, really tricky for one person to ever manage that saw. It's got to be two people working together on that saw. So I know they're very simplistic pictures and it's not perfectly collaboration, but what's the difference between those two where I could have done it by myself, but having someone help me makes it easier, and there's the other one where I really can't do it by myself?
The driving the spikes, the reason they tend to do that, one is speed, and the other is when you hit a spike, they're on the opposite side, so they tend to tilt it to that side.
Yeah, so it makes it go in straighter.
Yeah, it makes it go straighter. All right, so yeah. So yes,
but you can do it by yourself,
But you've got to be very aware of where you're hitting it.
But I don't think those big long saws you could do by yourself.
Because they're things for sawing timber out of logs. They're massive. And they used to saw them, like they used to dig a ditch. So one guy was under the saw, getting all the sawdust on him. Usually the son and the older dad would be up on the top because, you know, he got the sawdust when he was the son. The grandfather was on top. So or they'd swap. But, yeah, the two-handle, those saws, and they're lethal. They're like 10, 12 foot long. They're huge. And their teeth are massive. So you just can't push that through timber by yourself. It just.
I think both of these really illustrates different aspects of this in a really interesting way, because I've seen both the sort of Paris doing the driving off the spike, and I've seen actually illustrations of adding additional people to it. You can actually, I've seen at least fours, but as you add people to such an arrangement, the skill level and the synchronization needs drastically increases. And this have some, it goes faster, but it requires more coordination and more skill and more training. When you have that sort of equality, it gives a result you couldn't get by yourself, which is really interesting. What I think the other instance, the saw, actually illustrates is if you end up with the saw and you have one person not really doing the work, you end up with the same tension as in a lot of sort of failed collaborative efforts, where someone thinks that, well, I got a lot of social loafing or I have something else, that guy isn't pulling his weight. So you end up with that too. And I think that plays into the sort of, we need to feel that we have fairness of effort or fairness of commitment or sort of we can understand why one of us is getting all the sawdust or to an extent also we could accept that someone can't sort of pull the saw as hard or sort of because I'm the slightly bigger built or slightly more experienced one, and I can see that as sort of also paying into something that is greater than simply getting the sawing done, and that is introducing someone to the craft or sort of. But then there will be a power difference, quite literally in that case of the saw, but we accept that as part of the work too, and we still can successfully collaborate if we choose to. And if we don't accept it, we end up with tension and resentment, which seems to be happening a lot in many other contexts too.
All right, so the way I understand what we've done, we've distilled collaboration requires responsibility and respect. We have to acknowledge other people's, you know, skills or lack of skills even. You know, people may not have a skill, but they can develop it, but they may be sort of stronger in different areas. So that's when it becomes collaborative.
And what's super tricky in knowledge work is that we can't see the impacts of that. Whereas if we were driving in the spike and people would, not coordinated the right way, you can very quickly see what's going to happen. And the same with the big long saw. Like if there was uneven weight distribution and stuff like that, power distribution, you can see it. But in knowledge work, how does it manifest itself? How do we see the fact that these things aren't working the way that they could?
It's a tough question. Because that's why I like building things in the real world rather than computer programming and stuff. It's so easy to hide loafing. It's so hard. And even perceived loafing, people will see perceived loafing. I mean, if you can get it done in 5 minutes, they act like it wasn't a big job. but it would have taken them 3 hours. You know, like, it's not fair that they think you slacked off because you've developed the skills to get it done in 5 minutes.
Mm.
So that's not really loafing. That's efficiency. I always read that as efficiency, you know, and that's the goal. But, yeah.
I think that sort of, you end up with, it is, to a certain extent, when we can't observe the work or when we have don't have a shared vision of it, it's hard to judge when someone is just being super efficient at doing their part and when their part was smaller. It's hard to judge that correlation. If we're driving in the spike, if someone was unfortunate enough to have to team up with me driving in a spike, since I'm not particularly well built, they would quickly find that they do a lot of hammering and I do a tiny bit of hammering. And if we're unequally strong and sort of have unequal ability to lift the sledgehammer, that will make it harder to coordinate. If we have the same prerequisite strength, we can get an even rhythm. If one of us is substantially weaker, then that will either constrain the rhythm or we'll have to find some other way to work around that arrhythmic result. And I think you can find this tension within, if you look inside any group, you tend to find this. If it's not a homogeneous group, you find that the group itself knows who's sort of strong at what. And then the question becomes, how do we effectively deal with that? Because there's to a certain extent, if we find acceptance for it, we can find all of these other good parts of why we espouse collaboration in knowledge work. And that's not only the development of language or of knowledge, it's the development of the group. It's not only the development of the product, it's the development of the understanding and the capabilities of the team that's sort of tending to the product. So we can find these sort of, we're contributing different things, and that equalizes the strengths. I think that's one of the big problems that many tech organizations run into, is that we have a too narrow view on what is strength. We tend to look at it as a certain ability, and the group itself thus ends up not appreciating the different strengths or not being able to figure out how to leverage the strengths they have in a way that feels like loafing, or it feels like someone is free riding instead of going, okay, so how do we turn this around? Not saying that it doesn't happen, but we often also have the problem of not actually seeing the other things.
I think it's the culture sort of gotten to the, we don't care about the black box. We don't care. As long as we need to know. Minimum knowledge, minimum effort to get satisfactory result, which won't get you fired. Not even a good result, just minimum effort. And I think that's sad. We've moved away from the childlike curiosity of wanting to know how things fit together and wanting to know, what are you doing? Having a look over a cubicle and asking someone, what are you programming? You know, like popping your head around or talking over coffee, you know, oh, wow, I had a really hard problem on this. And someone said, oh, I did something like that in SAS or some other language. We try to stay so focused on efficiency that we actually kill it, because efficiency and appreciation of other people's work effort comes from understanding how things have to be put together. The irony is, I used to do ballet, right? I will always appreciate a dancer, because a dancer is the classic, you've got to make it look effortless. It's not. To make it look easy, you have to be really good at it, because it doesn't matter what form of dance and music, so anything. That's the beautiful thing of mastery. It looks simplistic. It looks like anyone can do it. I think the problem is we've moved away. We've focused more on efficiency and balance sheet, and we don't really look at the bigger picture of how everything clicks together. And that's where collaboration has trouble, because if we can't see the bigger picture, it's harder to see the strengths in different areas. You sort of see where I'm going with that?
So I'm going to come back to driving in the spike, right? Because physically, it's pretty easy to see what we're trying to achieve. Here's something that hasn't been put in, and we have to, you know, use the sledgehammers and get it put in. So it's very easy to agree on the outcome. As a group, we know what the outcome is. And then as a group, we would coordinate to, you know, hit the spike at the coordinated rhythms so that we can get it to its right spot. But knowledge work, you can't see what you're trying to achieve. So we end up having to spend quite a bit of time making sure that we've got the equivalent of we can all see the spike has to go in, whatever that is. We can all see that the outcome that we're trying to achieve is this. And then once we're clear on that, then we can start to coordinate our rhythm together and figure out how we're going to achieve it. So I think that's the thing that makes it really tricky, is knowing what the outcome is we're after together.
All right, okay. So we've got responsibility. I'm trying to work out a list here, you may notice. Responsibility, what was the other one? Respect or appreciation of other skills, you know, so not me, okay? And focus yours.
Clarity of outcome and purpose, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well,
I would term that as, I'll just borrow something that Gabe said, because Gabe says smart things all the time. I would call it requisite coherence. The idea being that we don't actually need to all align on what the outcome is perfectly.
Mm.
We need to have a shared enough picture of what it is. That limits how much we must actually converge. We must converge up until the point where we can effectively get it right enough. And I think that's really important, because I think that this is also where a lot of these things tend to go slightly off the rails, is that we end up discussing, we're driving for clarity, but what we end up driving so far for clarity that we think that we all need to agree to 100%, and that becomes an unnecessary big burden.
Mm.
Yeah, but I think the IT side, I used to dabble in IT, so what's happened in corporations is their idea of clarity is like a strategy. It's not clarity. It's not like where you want to go. It's like a dot-to-dot drawing of this step goes to this step goes to this step. When I hear clarity of purpose, it's not, it's like what's your goal and roughly which way you want to go about it. But where I think we all fall down, we all do it. I mean, I do it too, right? We tend to put in our chosen methodologies into the pursuit of the goal. And that's where we get into trouble, because then we assume everyone sees it the same way and everyone's going to follow in the same path. And that's where you get dissent.
Mm.
Kim's pondering. I can see her eyes are upturned.
So that's clarity about how we're going to go about it. So we need clarity of what we're trying to achieve, or the requisite coherence about what we're trying to achieve, and the requisite coherence about how we're going to go about doing it.
Yeah, I think I like doing things organically. Just start something, it'll tell you how to do it. Once you hit a problem, you either have to fix that or go in a different direction. It's self-navigating. It's sort of like a little pinball machine. It bounces around. Most people want to plan and want to know exactly where they're going, and they find it very hard to process things organically and let it develop. They sort of want the answer before they ask the question. And I think that's a sad statement on the way we tend to do things now. When you do woodwork, traditionally, you would use branches to make chairs, and you'd go with the shape of the branch. You know, that shape is there. That's a good handle for a tea kettle or something. So you'd use that natural shape into the design. Whereas now we'd actually machine it down to a chosen shape. So is a bit of a difference on how things work. But I reckon organically is where we sort of fall over when we collaborate. We don't let things breathe. We want an answer too quickly, so the dough doesn't rise.
So that has me thinking a lot about a few aspects that I think ties into this. One of them is a tolerance for ambiguity. And your tolerance for ambiguity usually goes up with expertise in an area. You know that there's more gray zones. Experience feeds into that. And your level of security, knowing that you can sort of actually appreciate the flows and see the dynamics rather than needing a recipe to follow. So, and that's tied to expertise, of course. So you have that, and you have the idea of cognitive load and how variance ties into that, the variance in different ideas. So a lot of ambiguity, a lot of variance around how we do and what we do and how we phrase things also drives a certain amount of cognitive load. And when we're trying to bring these not only into coherence but into alignment, the idea is that to a certain extent, we can de-skill, we can make it easier to enter this area, which makes it more scalable in a sense. It's easier to transfer. And we can lessen the cognitive load because there's already so many different things that we all, for various reasons, need to juggle on a day-to-day basis. But what it also does is that it over-constrains the system, as you were alluding to, that sort of the system itself actually loses its ability to breathe.
So we need breathing room.
Mm.
Breathing room for ambiguity.
Well, that's point four. I think that's a fair point. All right, I'm going to throw in a spanner. Here we go. Size of groups and which size of groups are best for certain things. And that's right at you two guys because you're the IT met type people. Because to me, collaboration has to be three. Minimum is three because any less is a partnership or solo effort, right? So it has to be three. That's the minimum. So
I've got a really nice workshop that goes for about 90 minutes and it works perfectly for the numbers between 3 and about 12. So I've run it a lot of times. I once ran it with about 20 people and it didn't work. So for that particular workshop, 3 to 12 people is fine. I think you can stretch it up to about 15, but I'd rather go less than more. So 12 is probably the real cap based on experience. And that's a workshop that requires people who have a deep level of expertise. It requires people with seniority and it requires a lot of really open discussion about feasibility of a piece of work. So for that kind of workshop, for that kind of time period, for that kind of outcome, 3 to 12 people will work.
Okay. Well, that's sort of where I sort of roughly had it. 3 and maybe 4 groups of 3, which is 12. That's the way I sort of thought was a rough thing. But then Toby threw out a number of 30 last time we were roughly talking about this. So
yeah, I'm curious about the 30. You've got different experiences, haven't you, Toby?
I'm curious about your 30 there.
I think that I have, I just view it as, so there's probably, someone is going to make the Dunbar connection over here, so let's just do that right off the bat. I think that there's actually, you have these fairly well-established social group norms, sort of, there's only so many social units that we can have a gainful relationship with. And I think that the nature and the feeling of the collaborations or the collaborative effort changes quite substantially. I think that the sort of 3 to 12 is where you can really have these good, fairly equal collaborations where sort of you need to have sort of you can scale it depending on how do we get all the perspectives we need. But at some point we become so many that we can no longer trust, or that there's simply, using the breathing metaphor, there's no airtime left. There's no breathing room for people's voices to be heard. Because if you're 30 people and you have 90 minutes, there's a very set limit on how much everyone can talk. 3 minutes doesn't give us a whole lot of ability to navigate ambiguity. So where I sort of stand on this sort of, well, we can scale collaboration, but we can only do that by scaling the units of collaboration. So I think that we can have a group of 30 people collaborating or working on a joint effort, but only by those people sub-segmenting into smaller units. And those would probably fall in the 3 to 12 or 5 to 15 natural groupings that tends to occur. So we get these clusters, but those clusters, if they overlap a tiny bit or in a high social capital system, when we start trusting the group rather than a person, we reach the point of trusting a system rather than a group, then we can to a certain extent say that we're scaling collaboration, but it does have a very different feel. But I think we can still say that it could fulfill our criteria of equality, responsibility, requisite coherence. So I think that we sort of can see these elements, but I also have a strong preference to the smaller group sizes because they have a much easier time navigating and negotiating all of the things we're already talked about. So that's sort of, I prefer smaller groups for all of those reasons and because of me not actually handling large groups very well. My favorite group size is 2. So I guess that makes it a partnership, not a collaborative effort.
Okay. All right. Let's have a look at this. All right. So let's say we've got 30 people. And you don't like dealing with larger groups, and I'm not a big fan of larger groups because it just becomes white noise. Then there's the other thing I want to look at is collaboration, and there's levels of what you collaborate over. There's stuff that's really important, like really important. Your company's going to go broke if you don't get this right. All your staff are out of work. That level of collaboration, you have to work this out, right? We all have to pull together and get through this. And then you've got like what colour should we have the new carpet in the hallway stuff? All right, you get the idea. There's extremes, right? It depends. So I think the funny thing about collaboration is what you're collaborating over affects the group size and how much input everyone puts in. Because what I've noticed is the more daunting the goal is, the collaboration is, the task, the more people will not volunteer and sort of put themselves in it because the responsibility is great. But if there's less responsibility in a collaboration, you get a lot of that extra to-ing and fro-ing in a larger group and everyone's opinion, you know, my opinion's more valid than yours because, you know, I think this is a nicer colour of carpet and blah, blah, blah. So I think that's an interesting thing to look at in collaboration, that you can end up with more people contributing and buying into basically the fluff, the things that don't really count. Whereas we always think collaboration is important for everything.
I think this is touching upon what's usually called Parkinson's law of triviality. And that's essentially, the observation is from the 50s or 60s, somewhere around there, where he wrote a fable around this. And sort of one of the decisions that our group had made was about the funding of a nuclear power plant. And the other one was about a bike shed. And the third issue was about free coffee for some specific committee. And of course, the time spent is almost nothing on the really, really big important question, because no one feels they can grasp and grapple with that one. So it's just sort of they give it a cursory glance and whatever the recommendation is, they go with that one, unless they have some very specific knowledge or some very specific point of view. And then we have the bike shedding problem, where everyone sort of have an idea about how to build a shed and what color it should be and all of these other things. And then for the trivial question of sort of, should we offer free coffee to some particular group where the cost is actually negligible, then you actually create a working group and a committee to discuss that on the next meeting. And you task someone with sort of gathering the numbers of the actual cents and dollars it would cost and all of these things. And I think that happens a lot, that especially as group sizes go up, our ability, unless we practice refocusing on the really important and sort of getting our expertise to bear, what we end up is discussing the trivialities. And in the tech sector, I think this is extremely prevalent in terms of if you get a large enough group of developers, the only thing they'll talk about is where do you put your curly braces, or do you use spaces or tabs to indent stuff? It's sort of nothing could actually matter less. It matters that you get it consistent, but sort of that's everyone can have an opinion on it. And it's sort of, as you say, you don't need to feel responsible for it. It doesn't require a whole lot of expertise. It only requires that you sort of have commitment to your chosen ideal, and you can debate this to no end. And I think that happens a lot. And I think that also limits, unless we have strong facilitation skills and unless we build really strong sensing networks within the groups, we devolve into that. And I think that's where partnerships, where solo work partnership and your initial 3-yo of collaboration. I'm seeing this now, that what it gives is the individual usually have an issue at heart that they care about. It's a big thing most of the time. And it's easy because no one will distract me from it. A partnership is usually formed because of a shared interest. And as the group size grows, if we don't ensure the requisite coherence and sort of purpose, then why are we here? Then what you will see, a rapid decline in how hard the questions are. And they will end up being sort of, what's the colors of the carpets and where do we do this thing, or sort of, What's the perfect naming of this particular thing? Not that naming isn't important, but it is quite possible to overdo the naming of a local variable only visible in a for loop. Trust me, I've seen it.
Yes, or the naming of a group that's, you know, responsible for transforming an area in the business. The naming can take 6 weeks.
All right, so we've stumbled onto, or tripped over, depending on your point of view, one of the problems with collaboration, and that is the more people that get involved, we tend to seek out, I won't say inconsequential, but less important tasks to busy our time with, because we don't want the responsibility of the big problem. Would that be fair?
I think that it's a fair perspective, and I'd like to add another one that was actually very well caught in a book I read recently by Mats Alvesson. So he's a Swedish author, so it's a play on words, so it doesn't translate very well, so I'll skip that bit. But the observation is around a very human tendency to converse, that if we're put in a group socially, and this is a really strong driving force within us, we feel that obligated to say something to belong. How we sort of, we have a lot of meetings are 75% social grooming. So if you're put in the group, you feel that you need to say something. And that's also why the trivial questions become so interesting for us. Because if I can't sort of say anything about all the complex things, I don't understand them, and I'm unsure of my social standing and all of these things, you're constantly searching for something that you can have an opinion on. And once you find it, you latch onto that thing in order to assert yourself as part of the group and to feel valuable and to feel valued and to feel included. And that, of course, can drive a lot of noise. And I think that, that's also attention to take into this. There's a certain bit of it's scary to be responsible for something for a whole slew of reasons. There's a whole lot of things that are really hard to reason about. They require expertise. And also we have the need for social belonging that is super important to always take into account. We can't build sustainable systems without taking the social aspects into account.
Am I the only one that sees a paradox with that? To fit into a group, you focus on self? I've got to focus on a question I can answer and I can feel comfortable with. But that way I fit into the group. Anyway.
Now that you put it that way.
I told you I don't look at it the same way. But yeah, I just thought that was funny. But it's perfect sense. It's perfectly the way, it's exactly how we do things. Like when you're doing a conversation, you try to interject a slither of self into the conversation. So there is a death knell. There's a death curve in the collaboration where it dies under its own mass, that it becomes non-efficient. But I think, in a nutshell, we've got 3 people to 12, maybe 15, and on certain topics, we can go up to 30 if we manage the subsets of the collaboration a little bit better.
Mm.
But on big questions, what I'm gathering here, on the hard questions and the bigger issues, 3 to 12 is sort of like where we want to be in.
I would say that for the majority of questions, that is what we can handle, given either what we already know and sort of the skills we already got, or what we can do with good facilitation and low startup costs.
Wow, that's good.
And I think that if we want to transcend that, that's when we need to invest. And I think the cost grows non-linearly. It's not that it's impossible. It's just exceedingly costly, and it requires us to develop skills and relationships and ways of being that doesn't come naturally to us. So I think that's the sort of, so I think that yes, as a heuristic, 3 to 12, 3 to 15 is probably a sweet spot, what most of us can do given the context we're in and the facilitation skills available to us.
And if we know the goal, what we need, and we show some respect and understand other people. Okay, I think we got a good framework actually out of that.
I think that's good.
All right, so you want to stop recording?
I think so.
Okay, right. I'll press the button then.